Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, October 28th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Albany Cardiothoracic Surgeons, providing patient-centered heart surgery for over 40 years in the Capital Region, practicing cardiac surgery at St. Peter's Hospital, ACTSURG.com. Joining us for Medical Monday is Dr. Jeremy Stopker, a family practice physician at Community Health Programs in the Berkshires. He is here to answer your LGBTQ health care questions. Medical Monday, always a popular show. Best to call early, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number, 800-348-2551. Dr. Jeremy Stopker, and your calls coming up after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Medical Monday today, and Dr. Jeremy Stopker, a family practice physician at Community Health Programs in the Berkshires, joins us today. He is here to discuss LGBTQ healthcare. Dr. Stopker graduated from Georgetown University School of Medicine in Washington, D.C. He practiced medicine in New York City until relocating to the beautiful Berkshires and CHP earlier this year. If you want to be a part of the conversation today, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. You can also tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Jeremy Stopker, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And thank you for clearing up the pronunciation of your name. We had Stopker, but it's Stopker, right?
It's, for most people, Dr. Jeremy.
All right, you know what? I'll probably screw it up at least three or four times in the program, so please bear with us. The bio on the website for CHP is quite extensive, and there's a quote in there that I was taken by, and you said, "There's nothing different about caring for LGBTQ patients. It's just good medical care, the same good medical care everyone deserves. You listen non-judgmentally more than you talk, with an open mind to whatever your patient brings into the room." So the question I have for you to begin the program is, what have you heard from LGBTQ patients about the challenges? Given that we are all humans, everybody is concerned about the same ailments. My
sure.
lungs, my heart, my
sure.
vascular system, my joints, everything hurts. What have you heard about special challenges in getting care for LGBTQ patients?
You know, I don't think it's much different what I've heard so far practicing for 5 months in the Berkshires than honestly what I heard in New York. And despite my conceptualization of the city and what I think a lot of people think of the city, where it should be no big deal, it should be just assumed that that's fine and cool with everybody there, it's totally not. People bump their heads into judgment.
Who? The doctors?
The patients.
The patients bunch into judgments. But why?
Oh, that's a broader question than I can answer.
All right.
But what I hear is that they're frustrated with people not being open or even asking questions or feeling physically uncomfortable in a space, which I don't think is unique to medicine.
Well, yeah.
When you're from any minority group, it doesn't matter if you're gay or anything else, sometimes that's uncomfortable.
So what have you done and how do you approach this?
I, as much as possible, make sure people feel comfortable no matter what their situation is. Again, you don't have to be gay to feel uncomfortable in a doctor's office. It's uncomfortable for a lot of people.
Oh, yeah, it is.
And I think anything any doctor can do to make people more comfortable is great. And we try to do that particularly for the LGBTQ population in my clinic by making sure people are comfortable using whatever pronoun you're comfortable with, or by making sure our records reflect whatever name you'd like to be referred to as, and by asking questions non-judgmentally.
You went to medical school at Georgetown and obviously a well-credentialed doctor. What brought you to this avenue?
Well, my dad was a flamboyantly flaming homosexual. And so it was a huge part of my youth. And he was actually diagnosed with HIV when I was really young, probably I think around the age of 7.
Oh, that's a scary thing for a 7-year-old.
Well, and at that time, this is in the mid-80s, he was told that he would have a year to live. And then he lived for a year, and then he lived for another year. And he had these amazing, open, non-judgmental, incredibly caring doctors, even in the 80s, even in rural Michigan, where we were. And they were my heroes. They kept my dad alive, which is a big thing when you're 7 years old or 10 years old, or if you're 50 years old, it's an awesome thing, but it was particularly awesome then.
He lived into your 20s.
He lived into my 20s. He lived to see me graduate from medical school and to get married.
And did you know from an early age you wanted to do medicine? Was this one of the reasons?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I dressed up as a doctor every Halloween since the age of 8. And I think probably still we'll do that again this year.
You know, a lot of people don't dress up as radio people. It's funny.
I don't know how you would.
Yeah, that's a good point. Our number here, walk around with headphones. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Jeremy Stopker is our guest today. And we talk healthcare on a Medical Monday, and specifically LGBTQ healthcare. And our number, once again, is 800-348-2551. Let's go to Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
Could you talk about the need for vision and dental coverage in general?
The need for vision and dental coverage in general. All right. Doc?
I think dental and vision coverage are needed. Is there a question?
Well, I can remember when a doctor's visit used to cost $3. Nowadays, when you got all this health insurance and stuff, that you're paying more in copays than used to be when it was just straight fee.
Jim, this is an important topic, right? You're asking about access to care, and it's incredibly important for everyone. I think it's incredibly important if you're gay or straight, if you're part of the LGBTQ community. It's harder to find people that are open to that. If you have dental issues, sometimes it's hard to find access to that. It's sometimes hard to find a vision provider. In the Berkshires, man, I got to tell you, I just moved there a year ago. I'm having a hard time just finding a dentist that can get me in. It's a 6-month wait for me to get a cleaning. It's a big problem across all of healthcare.
All right, Jim, thanks a lot for that one. 800-348-2551. And of course, access to healthcare is probably the topic of another show, but well handled, Doctor. Let's take a quick break here, and then we'll get back to the calls. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Dr. Jeremy Stopker is our guest on a Medical Monday. We'll be right back. Thank you, Zach, the engineer. It's Medical Monday. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Dr. Jeremy Stopker is here. He is with the family practice. He's a family practice physician at Community Health Programs. Community Health Programs does a lot more than that, though, right?
Indeed. Part of the reason I joined is because they really, true to the name, care about the health of the community. They're really active in getting health to as many people as they possibly can. They seem to walk the walk more than most organizations that I've seen.
And you had your choice of where you wanted to work, I assume.
You saw my resume.
I saw your resume. And, you know, the one thing about doctor resumes is they tend to be rather extensive. And this is no exception. Back to the phones we go. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Janine in Scaticoke. Janine, you're on.
Hey, good afternoon. So considering that the majority of medication studies are based on Cockcroft-Gault using actual body weight, and Cockcroft-Gault is based on, you know, that male and female, when we're doing this and as this population ages, particularly the patients who have had gender reassignment surgery, how should we go about calculating the Cockcroft-Gault? Because a lot of medications are dosed based on their renal function.
Explain first, before you answer the question, what it is Janine is referring to.
So if I'm understanding your question, you're asking about figuring out medication doses for patients who don't have great kidney function. And that's fortunately a small subset of the population. And I think aging...
But I know this population will be aging and things will, you know, we'll get there.
You're bringing up, Janine, you're bringing up a very big topic. And I think particularly practicing in the Berkshires, where there's a lot of aging population, is that do we have adequate healthcare resources for an aging population in general? Do we have adequate resources prepared to handle an aging LGBTQ population? And I think one of the last frontiers of medical professionals learning about good LGBTQ care is definitely in the elderly. And we're hoping to change that. I'm really involved as much as I can be in education of the residents. I still have sort of a toe in the door at Columbia, and I'm working with some community college students. And so this question is incredibly specific, but I think the broader topic of what are we doing to get health professionals up to speed with the specific needs of this community as they age is very tricky. I think the standard medical answer for your question is going to be that we're probably going to use gender assigned at birth, because despite effects of hormonal changes, the chemistry is still as closer to the gender of birth, as far as we know. But
muscle mass would be similar.
But
right?
Here's hoping we have more studies in the near future on these things. It's also an incredibly small subset of the population where the male versus female difference in that calculation is going to be clinically relevant or is going to make a difference in the dose of the medication that you're giving. We're also moving over towards the MDRD regression for calculating creatinine clearance, which is really boring stuff
true.
To talk about for a broader audience on the radio.
Well, it's very specific, that's for sure.
But I think you bring up a great point in that how are we going to have everybody who takes care of an aging population and especially a boomingly large LGBTQ population and the specifics
of
that?
I work at Albany Med and I work with that group. So they're the sickest, not that group, but the patients are the sickest. The medications are, you know, we do this all the time.
Right.
In the hospital setting.
Right.
So in order to optimize the care of a critically ill, you know, individual, that's why I asked.
I think it's an important question. As far as I'm aware, there are no guidelines, but that doesn't mean they're not out there.
Janine,
hoping we have something.
Thanks for the call. Our guest today is Dr. Jeremy Stopker from Community Health Programs in the Berkshires. The number is 800-348-2551. You mentioned at the start of the show that when you were a kid in the 80s, your father was diagnosed with HIV, given a year, maybe lived 20 years. What have scientists and medical professionals learned about HIV and AIDS that has extended lifespans in the intervening years?
You know, it's true for HIV and it's true for a lot of nasty diseases that we now just consider chronic conditions. Don't get me started on the politics of large drug companies designing therapeutics that keep people alive without curing them. But we're really good at that.
Stop. Are you then intimating that the large pharmaceuticals could, in fact, cure them and don't want to?
No, I'm definitely not. But we certainly put a lot of money into drug development, and it is a lot easier to treat something or to keep it tamped down than to cure it. And it's the way the economics of our current medical industrial complex are set up. But we've done a great job of it. You know, HIV is no longer a death sentence. It's very much a chronic disease. The medications are really easy. And now the more exciting thing is that preventing it is incredibly easy.
All right, we'll talk about that in a moment. You talk about HIV becoming a chronic, in other words, cancer, various cancers, even 10, 20 years ago, you got that word. It
done.
Was a death sentence.
Right.
Things are changing. And so is this early detection that is changing the outcomes, or what exactly is happening?
No, it's not. It's not early detection at all, because we've always been pretty good at that. It's just better drugs. The medications that my dad took in the 80s ravaged his body. He was a shell of a human after 20 years of this. It was incredibly hard to watch. And part of that was the effect of HIV, and part of that was the effect of the medications. And the dosing regimen was incredibly complicated.
I remember, expensive, as I recall.
Insanely expensive, although thank goodness there have always been great programs for that. But, you know, it took a master's degree to sort out the which pills were before food and which pills were after food and which pills were with food and which pills were in the morning and in the evening. And it was this huge organizer of 23 different medications per day. And now for most people with HIV, it's one pill once a day. It works incredibly well. You will die of something else, not of HIV, if you can just stick with getting this one pill once a day. And, you know, the previous caller brought up one of the topics that makes it complicated, which is if your kidneys are in failure or if you're having other organ issues, that complicates things. But for the majority of people, it's gotten really easy to both prevent and to treat.
The number here is 800-348-2551. If you have a question for Dr. Jeremy Stopker today, Dr. Jeremy Stopker focuses on LGBTQ healthcare, does many other things. He is a graduate of Georgetown University School of Medicine in Washington, practiced in New York City, now in the bucolic Berkshires. 800-348-2551. You had mentioned in our previous exchange that there is a way to prevent HIV that is not the standard way.
This is, so yeah, you can always not have sex.
Right.
But we don't encourage that. That would be incredibly mentally unhealthy.
Well, if you're a monk or something, right? Or you know.
Maybe,
right.
Maybe. But now it has gotten much easier. In fact, the news on this has changed. Just in the last 2 weeks, there's a second medication, but let's focus on this topic more in general. You can take a pill once a day. It, for most people, has absolutely no side effects.
That you know of.
You know, the great thing about this is actually it's not a new drug. It's not an experimental thing at all. It's a medication we've used to treat HIV for quite a long time, I think over a decade. And so we have a good long safety record with this medication, the most commonly used one being Truvada. Mm-hmm. It's easy to take. You take it once a day. Every once in a while, people will have some upset stomach with it, but most people have nothing. And it's almost 100% effective for preventing HIV.
What does it do?
It does. We're not 100% sure. Proving something works.
Time out. Isn't that a problem?
No. There are incredible examples all through conventional Western medicine of things that work that we have absolutely no idea why they work. And who cares? It works. The outcome is the most important thing. Why is totally irrelevant here, but it works great. And it's worked great for a lot of people to keep their HIV, as we were just discussing. It was one of those, usually in combination with something else, that was given once a day that did a great job keeping people's HIV from causing problems in their life. We now know that it also works incredibly well if you remember to take it, and that is the key. You have to remember to take it every day. And if you do, no matter how much sex you're having, you probably won't get HIV, which is really exciting. It's also free.
What do you mean it's free?
If you have insurance to cover the majority of the cost, which now where I'm practicing in the Berkshires, amazingly, basically everyone has.
Yeah.
The drug company itself covers your copay up to a pretty high amount of money.
The number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Jeremy Stopker is our guest today. And we'll get back to the phones in a minute. This email came in from Chris, and Chris wants to know, when prospective doctors are in med school, are there courses on cultural competence that are mandated for them to take? This could only be a good thing moving forward. And that's from Chris.
So there are, and I can't speak for all med schools in the whole country. Most medical schools design their curriculum to make it so that students pass the tests that they have to take to become doctors. And the tests, fortunately, have become much more focused on people at least having clinical competency, if not cultural competency. And I think, yes, this definitely happens to a certain extent in some med schools way more than others. My med school had a particular focus on it, which is part of why I picked it. But residencies where you really learn medicine, again, to widely varying degrees, have a lot of this incorporated, and mine had a lot of it incorporated for a lot of different cultures.
When you were in residency, did you notice, are there certain personality types that just don't make it? In other words, if you're working at a restaurant and you're in the cooking area of a restaurant, some people just don't, that they're not cut out for that sort of thing, and they wash out very quickly.
So not a lot of people wash out of either med school or residency. Once you're in, and it's not easy to get in to either one, most people get through. And I think part of that is a credit to how hard it is to get in. And part of that is a credit to the people in those programs that are there to support when you're struggling, to not just dump you out, but to hopefully teach you whatever deficiencies that you're missing.
But I mean, you mentioned the clinical competency and the cultural competency.
Sure.
Some people are nicer than others.
This is very specialty specific. When you go to medical school, you have no idea whether you're going to sit in a lab in front of a microscope all day, every day, or you're going to be sitting in a room talking to a different patient every 10 to 20 to 30 minutes like I do. And fortunately, the sifting process of people figuring out what their personality would fit with usually works pretty well. And sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes somebody thinks they're going to do something, and then it turns out to be a terrible fit, and they'll oftentimes switch to something else.
Our guest today is Dr. Jeremy Stoker. Stopker is the name. Our number is 800-348-2551. Mark that down. That's the first time I got your name wrong, I think. Let's go to Arthur in Pauling. Arthur, you're on.
Yes, I would like to know, when one undergoes gender reassignment surgery, and then one has to take hormones for the rest of their lives, right?
Well, you don't have to, but most people choose to because they feel more comfortable in their body when they do.
Oh, all right. And once they start taking the hormones, doesn't that in and of itself create medical problems?
That's a highly controversial topic. A lot of people take hormones, even if they're not transgendered, to treat certain conditions. And a lot of the initial research that we had both on testosterone and estrogen replacement therapies, we now are understanding pretty wildly overblew the risks of them, actually. And they turn out to probably be quite protective for some conditions and maybe increase the risk of some things. But, you know, that's true of just about everything you put in your body, salt included, man.
What?
Okay. All right. Well, I'm 72. And I'm taking 100 milligrams of testosterone, DHEA a day. I've been doing it for about 6 years, and I feel incredibly, much more vigorous and active in general. Not just sexually, but in my general health is tremendously helped.
That's great, and you can imagine how amazing it would be for someone who felt like they were in the wrong body. And not just got more energy, but got something in their body that made them feel more like who they were, how incredible that could be also.
All right, but if you start out as a female and you take testosterone to help you become more male, isn't that some kind of biological conflict that can result in some kind of bad medical conditions?
It's a really interesting question. You know, when we first are conceived and we're developing in our mother's womb, our gender doesn't develop immediately. There are triggers that take us down different pathways, but we all start out exactly the same, and the body usually can handle whichever. And I think it also brings up the point that if you are in a body that you don't feel is your body or the body that you were born to have, you're probably willing to take on some risks. If somebody told you that this testosterone therapy that you were taking was putting you at incredibly increased risk of X, Y, or Z condition, but man, you just felt so much more amazing taking it, you'd probably consider keeping taking it. Everything we do in life has risks. Everything we do in life has benefits. And each individual should have a doctor who's supportive of whatever decision they make and helps them figure out what those risks, what those dangers are, what the benefits are, and has an open and honest conversation with them.
I mean, we do hear scare stories about, I'm 75, I can pick up a Volkswagen, I take the testosterone pills now, but I had a heart attack. I mean, there are side effects, right? Our caller was not wrong.
You bring up probably one of the most controversial topics in testosterone replacement therapy, which is, does it increase the risk of heart attacks or does it decrease the risk of heart attacks? And you can find studies that support both.
Well, isn't that
It's not decided.
Is that not a problem, then, of science? If we have two studies that tell us exactly different things, what are we, the public, supposed to know?
We're really not going to solve that today. That is well beyond. It's a great topic. I'm thrilled to come back next Monday and have that conversation. But today we're talking more about LGBTQ health and those issues.
All right.
But I think there's a deeper underlying question that this caller has, and is it that if you were born with a female body and you start to do things to make it male, is the body going to reject that, or is that going to cause problems? And I got to tell you, we're just not seeing it. We're absolutely not seeing it. And the mental health benefits for the patient are dramatic.
Dr. Jeremy Stopker is focused, a laser-like focus on the topic here at hand on a Medical Monday. Oh, it's old home week. Let's go to Grandma Dorothy in Michigan. Hello, you're on. Oh, you got to turn your radio down, Grandma. Hello? I don't want to hang up on your grandmother. Zach, the engineer, is shaking his head. Oh, my gosh. Shall we? All right, Dr. Jeremy's grandmother, could you call us back? I've got to move on. I apologize, doctor. I really do.
I'll call her back later. It's
okay,
not a crisis.
Fair enough. Melinda in Great Barrington. Melinda, you're on.
Hi. First of all, thank you so much for covering these important topics. I just love the way the doctor's talking about them. It's so positive and healthy, and I really appreciate it. I'm calling because my 23-year-old daughter is HIV positive. She was contracted from her biological mother, and she's been undetectable since she was about five and takes Odefsey and is, for the first time, in a very serious committed relationship and thinking about what that means in terms of having, at some point, unprotected sex. And she's sort of been told two different things. One is that she needs to be taking the medications like the ones that you described a little while ago. And the other is that since she is not detectable and takes the medication and is checked every 3 months, he doesn't need to take that. What's your feeling on that?
Well, I'm thrilled that you asked the question the way you asked, because it's very much a feeling. We're getting better and better data that would argue that your daughter's partner does not need to take any medication whatsoever. That if your daughter is truly undetectable, and the tests are very good for this now, that there's probably very little risk to whatever partner she may have in them sexually transmitting HIV from one person to the other. That said, we're also in a really exciting new time where people can take PrEP, which is the topic we had brushed on earlier, which stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis, where her partner could potentially just take one pill once a day and then be even more confident.
Forever, though, right?
For as long as they're sexually active without condoms. Or even a lot of patients will use this as sort of backup with condoms. In fact, that's what we encourage people to do if you're really worried. Is to have as many layers of protection as you feel mentally comfortable with. Nobody's ever going to come out and say it is 100% certain that your daughter doesn't need to use condoms and that her partners don't need to be on any medication. We think that we're probably at a time where we're relatively comfortable saying that, but that's a really uncomfortable thing for a lot of people to say, and there's lots of ways to even further reduce that risk.
Melinda, thanks for the call. Now, how is it that her daughter could suddenly become undetectable?
That's the standard. Most people with HIV are now undetectable. The drugs are so good that the tests can't pick up any virus left in their system. Now, we know that when they stop medication, the levels will go back up. And so the question has been, does that mean they're cured? And we're pretty sure the answer is an unfortunate no for now.
Our guest today is Dr. Jeremy Stopker. It's 800-348-2551. And I believe his grandma's on the line. And we'll get to her right after the call. Grandma, don't hang up. We'll be back. breathing carefully. Do not cough before Zach opens the microphone. Thank you, Zach, the engineer. Appreciate it. It's Vox Pop Medical Monday. And Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Dr. Jeremy Stopker is our guest today. And, well, let's see. Dorothy in Michigan, hello. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
You're on. Go ahead.
I wanted to thank Jeremy for being on and say how much his dad helped other people, too. We saw somebody in the mall the other day and said that his dad helped her 8.5-year-old son so many years ago.
That's nice. What do you want to say? Hey, while your grandson is answering, could you just turn that radio down? Just
help you turn somebody else.
You turn that radio down just a little bit, Dorothy?
Yeah.
That would be great.
Turn it down. They can't hear me.
That would be swell.
Wally.
That would be.
He can't hear me either. Wally.
Oh, okay.
Turn it down. He can't hear me.
Well, we'll have Zach the engineer turn you down a little bit, and your grandson can talk to you. Go ahead.
Hi, Graham. It's a long, amazing family tradition of helping people.
I can't hear you either.
Oh, boy. Oh, this is not going well. All right.
I'm sure everyone will tell you about it later, though. It's an incredible opportunity to honor my father's legacy, to be on the radio show today, to be a part of this conversation, to be advocating for this community.
Do you know Jeremy?
Hello?
Okay. Yeah.
Yes, Jeremy. Jeremy's here. Jeremy's here talking to you.
Yeah, he's my grand. Jeremy is my grandson.
Yes, yes. Well, Dorothy, I tell you what. How about Jeremy gives you a shout after the program? It has been a pleasure.
Fine, that's fine. Sure.
It has been a pleasure having you on the program, and we thank you for being with us. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number, and let's go over to Queensbury. Ay, caramba. Oh, boy. Brandon, are you there? No, Brandon's gone. Well, what fresh hell is this? Debbie and Troy. Hello, Debbie.
Hello.
Hello, you're on, and you sound very good.
I have a question. I have a child who was born male and is transitioning to female. He's been on estrogen therapy and I think aldactone, but doesn't seem happier, just... You know, is always very depressed, crying all the time, a lot of anxiety, almost like a woman, you know, with a bad period, and I don't know how to help her.
Debbie, that must be really hard.
Terrible.
Yeah, to watch a child suffer, your own child suffer especially, is incredibly challenging. And it sounds like it hasn't been the easiest road for your child.
No, not at all. I thought she'd be happier, but...
But not
then
yet.
We have, you know...
But not,
not yet,
yet,
no.
Debbie.
How old is...
Yeah, I'm always hoping for 27.
And it's been a challenging road, especially being in a society that isn't incredibly accepting of the transition that your child made.
We have been totally accepting. I have never been negative about it. I never saw it coming, but... You know, it is what it is.
That's an amazing credit to you as a family, but we still live in a society that makes this incredibly challenging. Well, you know, we finally have some TV shows about it. It's become a topic in the pop culture, but day to day today, what I hear from my patients who are transgendered is that it's still an incredibly challenging world to live with, and it's fantastic that you were supportive of your child. That's so often not the case and a huge source of emotional distress for so many people in the trans community in particular. And I commend you massively for that. And I would encourage you to just
How can I help her, though? How can I help
there.
Her?
You know, getting her access to as much of the mental health she can possibly get is a really tricky thing. And this brings up another topic is that, you know, it doesn't matter what your gender orientation or sexual orientation may be, it's still hard to find a good therapist anywhere in this country. And when you do, they're oftentimes incredibly expensive. And advocating for that, advocating for the mental health of your child is something you should do and keep doing and keep doing until you guys get to the place where you need to be. And just loving them for who they are, which it sounds like you've also been doing a great job of. But there's no, you know, know, there's no specific one medication that works great for trans patients. And there's no specific dose of hormones that all of a sudden alleviate all the mental health anguish that someone has gone through. Growing up trans in this country is oftentimes incredibly traumatic, and healing trauma, whether it's from being a veteran in a war or being abused as a child or being a gender, being not feeling that you are the gender that you were born with, can be a trauma that people take many, many, many years to fix. So stick with it. You'll get better.
Debbie, thanks for the call. Our number here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Dr. Jeremy Stopker is here with Community Health Programs in the Berkshires. He's here to discuss LGBTQ health care. And let's go to Jen in Housatonic. Hello, Jen.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. So, Dr. Jeremy, I just wanted to, I'm sure you're aware, if you're treating transgender clients, about the WPATH Standards of Care, the World Professional Association on Transgender Health. But I wanted to make sure that all of the listeners know about the WPATH Standards of Care. I am a member of the LGBT community, and I am a mental health provider for the LGBTQ community.
Can you explain it to me, Jen, what the WPATH standards are?
Sure. It's the World Professional Association on Transgender Health. It is the standards of care that every doctor, every therapist, every person who treats transgender folks should be following. What most of my patients are coming across here in the Berkshires is that their doctors have never heard of it when they're trying to access transgender care. So, yes, they've gotten, you know, their endocrinologist has heard of it, but their primary care physician or their pediatrician hasn't.
Why have they not heard of it?
Dr. Jeremy can speak to why doctors may not have heard of the best practices for different kinds of patients or not. I don't know.
All right.
It's a hot topic in all of medicine, right? Is as there's an explosion of knowledge, what do we pick to teach medical students and what do we pick to teach residents? And how can we get doctors who've been practicing for 40 years or 60 years up to speed on the latest topics in medicine? And I don't think it's something that we're going to solve on the radio show, but people like you paying attention and advocating is a huge step in the right direction. And I'm on the team. I'm here with you, and we'll keep doing everything we can to spread the word. In Massachusetts, we have another great organization, Fenway Health, that does incredible initiatives to educate the population, and especially healthcare providers. CHP is applying to go through one of their programs that would do a lot to get the entire organization more up to speed with what all the guidelines and recommendations are to be more open and accepting of trans health, which I think is a great step in the direction.
Oh, that would be really fantastic because it's, you know, most people want to be great with their patients, I've found, and most people are not so great with their patients. Even myself having to argue after, you know, almost 40 years, no, I don't need a pregnancy test.
I'm sorry you've had to go through that. It's an unfortunate reality for a lot of folks.
Well, Jen, thanks for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday. Dr. Jeremy Stopker is our guest. 1-800-348-2551. What are some of the new advances in sexual health testing that we may not know about yet?
That's a great question. I think a big problem that we're seeing specifically in the Berkshires is that if you are a man who's having sex with other men, the guideline, the recommendation, is that when you're tested for STDs, you have what we would call a triple swab, which is where we check for gonorrhea and chlamydia in your throat, potentially in your rectum, and as we would normally do for all comers, if there's any gonorrhea or chlamydia in the urethra where you just pee in a cup. And this is incredibly easy to do. It's a Q-tip, a little swab that we use to swab the back of your throat like you would have a swab for strep throat, one other Q-tip in the rectum, and then you pee in a cup, and then you're completely and totally tested. It's come to everyone's attention who's paying attention in the last couple of decades that you can have gonorrhea and chlamydia in a lot of different places, and if we don't test for it, we don't find that it's there, and then it can easily be spread.
In other words, these STDs don't migrate throughout the entire body. They stay where they are?
They mostly stay where they are. I'll use the analogy again of strep. Just like a strep throat usually just stays in your throat and does not spread to the whole body, gonorrhea and chlamydia can do the same thing. They stay in one place.
What is the STD that is the most on the rise now?
It's changing dramatically, and it depends on the geographic area. It depends on your sexual orientation. It depends on the site that's tested. And there's no one that's winning the race if we're considering it that way. But they're all around. They're not going anywhere. And if we don't test for them, we don't treat them, and then they go on to other people. PrEP has been a bit of a gift in that most people who are on it are getting tested by people who know well enough to triple screen. We're hopefully going to be finding more of this early as more people are getting tested more regularly. It's very easy to treat, and then it's completely gone, and it's not spread to 10 other people before we find out.
But why not a PrEP for gonorrhea or syphilis?
If it exists, I'm the first guy to prescribe it, but we don't have it yet.
Our number is 800-348-2551. Maria in Albany. Maria, you're on.
Hi, gentlemen. Question. I listened to a story. I heard a story about a 6 or 7 year old child whose mother was advocating for a transition of a sexual transition, gender transition, and there was, I don't know whether this was sort of lighting a gas fire over this issue, but they were arguing that, you know, it's inappropriate. In the doctor's opinion, is there sort of a time frame for the appropriateness of an adolescent or a child to make a gender transition?
I think my easiest answer is that we still have no idea and that every case is unique. I've had patients who knew when they were at the very beginning of understanding themselves as a human that they were either gay or transgendered. And I've had other patients who came to the decision or the realization much later and maybe more in hindsight realized that maybe they had been that way all along and hadn't had an awareness of it, but we're in a society where that's changing dramatically. There's a lot of talk about this because if you do realize early enough and are comfortable completely with the idea that someone could know that early, that if you do take action, then you can have a much more successful transition if the hormones of adolescence haven't already dramatically altered the body.
All right, Maria, thanks for the call. Well, that is a point of controversy. How early is too early, and who makes that call?
It's a very, very controversial topic. And I personally don't make this decision for my patients. I don't feel comfortable making the decision or making the call, and I don't have an age cutoff in my head that automatically somebody is emotionally prepared. I think there's some 8-year-olds out there who are in a much better emotional place than some of the 50-year-olds that I meet, and vice versa. And so I think each case has to be unique, and that's part of why having a whole team of people who are as aware of the needs of the LGBTQ community out there is important, and having therapists that are trained in this exact topic, which is constantly evolving, so that a whole team can be involved to support not just the patient, but the whole family in figuring out when the best time, if they are going to make a transition, when that would be. And if it's definitive in a specific case that it's before puberty, there are very clear advantages to that because the body hasn't been changed by the hormones that the person was born with.
Do you have, and without speaking in specifics, have you or do you now have a patient who is pre-puberty who is in transition?
Most certainly.
And who makes the parents make the call?
No, especially when it's a child, there's a lot of people involved that make the call. So
what if they're wrong?
Then you can transition the other way. I think a lot of people get incredibly focused on the surgical involvement of potential transitions. And my experience is that most people who are experiencing it have a lot less focus on that than on the hormones and how they affect them and how they feel and how other people perceive them. And this is something that I hope we have so many more guidelines about to come in the future, and we have so many more therapists who are open to the idea of helping patients and children and families explore this and figure out when the ideal place would be. I would love that information, and we'll all just sort of keep our ears to the ground and listening to what the patient needs.
Dr. Jeremy Stopker is our guest, and let's go to Lisa in the Berkshires. Lisa, you're on.
Hi. I'm sorry. I actually just wanted to ask a question based on your comment about some of the STIs staying in specific locations.
Sure.
And is HPV one of them?
So HPV is something that's really hard to study. And
why?
Inherent to the fact that it's a virus and not a bacteria, and it's a wily one at the hat.
Okay.
And we are pretty sure that it does stay in a specific site once it has populated that site. What needs to happen for it to populate that site and what needs to happen to clear it out, we are still unsure. But there's some amazing data in, just to get into some specifics, in actually throat cancer patients where we've now realized that if they get chemotherapy and the Gardasil vaccine, which is the HPV vaccine, they are dramatically less likely to have a recurrence of that cancer than if they just got the chemotherapy, which makes us pretty sure that getting HPV out of the body, and specifically getting HPV out of a site of the body, then makes it less likely to do what it usually does, which is cause cancer. Although, fortunately, that's incredibly rare. Most people just clear it out on their own, and it doesn't cause any problems.
All right, Lisa, we'll have to leave it there, but thank you very much for the call, and we appreciate everybody calling today. Well, doctor, go ahead. You have few seconds.
I just want to plug the fact that we can now give the HPV vaccine to people up to the age of 45. It was originally recommended just for women and just for young women. It's now incredibly important for people of all ages, especially if you're having sex with multiple partners, to prevent throat cancer, rectal cancer, and what it was originally designated for, which is cervical cancer. It's wildly effective. It's a good, safe vaccine, and now a lot more people can get it. Insurance is covering it. Go see your provider. Please ask about this.
Dr. Jeremy Stopker, thank you for being here. And listen, call your grandmother and apologize for me, all right?
We talked about sex, and my grandma was on the phone.
Yeah, and she apparently couldn't hear, so everything was fine.
Probably better.
Support comes from Patricia Fennell and the Scleroderma Research Foundation. Spotlight the interprofessional education event for healthcare professionals, the Sage College of Health Sciences, and Albany College of Pharmacy, November 4th, albanyhealthmanagement.com. Well, thanks again to Dr. Jeremy Stopker for being here today. Thank you for joining us and for the calls. Thanks to Zachary Malloy, our long-suffering engineer. Well done again. Thanks to Joe Makowitz and Jim Harrison, who handled the calls. Thanks to Jim Lavoulis, our producer. I'm Ray Graff. We'll switch gears tomorrow, in a way. Alan Ayers of Chris and Foley Brothers will be here to answer your plumbing questions. Right now, stand by for the Media Project.